Hello everyone and welcome to the 49th episode of Yes Sir, Hey Sir. As usual, my name is Mark and I'm with...
Yes, you're with me, Mark, for the 49th time, Dennis. My name's Jersey.
And I think you just came back from Guernsey, right? So how was the weather in Guernsey?
Well, pretty much the same as Jersey. It's only about 26 miles away, slightly north. Very similar island, a little bit quieter, smaller population, but essentially similar, self-governing like Jersey is, and even separate from Jersey in government. So interesting place, nice beaches. It's, if you like a nice quiet break, it's and the weather's good, it's pretty cool.
Actually, I'm curious, how do you actually get over to Guernsey from Jersey? Do you have to fly or do you take a ferry or something?
Okay, yeah, you can. In fact, I flew. If you fly, it's about 10 minutes, 12 minutes. Ferries, about 50 minutes. There are people that swim it, I believe, but it's not something that I'd consider.
Well, there are people who actually swam the entire channel from France to the UK.
Oh, yeah, so what's
swimming across from island to island?
I don't know what the currents are like, whether anybody's ever done it. But I've never pursued that one. I think I'd rather go in the boat.
Okay, so for today's episode, I thought we would talk a little bit about, considering the fact that we are again emerging from COVID, and I think there's a lot of opportunity now to rebuild good relationships with students. And I think this was an area of work that you were looking at quite closely before you left Singapore. To enjoy fishing and the wonderful balmy weather in Jersey, is this idea about using autonomy supporting style for teaching. Now, for the benefit of all our listeners, and because you really did dive deep into it, and I can attest to it because I was working closely with you on this, can you explain exactly what is autonomy supporting?
Okay. The person that we worked closely with was John Marshall Reeve.
Nice guy. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, working very much within a self determination theory model, Desi and Ryan. Desi. Yep. I mean, those guys. And self determination theory is probably the most validated of theories of motivation. That's an interesting point. As we know, there's so many theories of motivation, and I think it was Peter Drucker who said, we've written dozens or hundreds or thousands of books on motivation, but we know nothing about it. So, you know, it's an interesting area, motivation, what actually gets people to do stuff. And you and me would have grown up with Maslow's hierarchy of needs,
you know, that.
Yeah, and it kind of populates virtually every psychology textbook, but it's actually not really got much by way of validation. Whereas self-determination theory, which is quite simple at a certain level, it talks about that we have three basic universal psychological needs, which is kind of mastery, autonomy, and relatedness. Mastery is often called competence. Mm-hmm. I think that if students feel that they are mastering something, they're being competent, they've got a sense of choice, autonomy, and they feel part of something, relatedness, they're much more likely to be more intrinsically motivated. In other words, that they want to participate in the learning, not because they're being given chocolate. I mean, chocolate always works, doesn't it? I mean, you could probably write a book on kind of, you know, the relationship between giving kids chocolate and ice cream, particularly Argendaz, and item performance and whatever. That's true. I mean, it gives them a little bit of a dopamine fix, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's well researched. Anyway, but going back to the point is that if you're giving chocolates out and extrinsic rewards all the time, teachers would be bankrupt, wouldn't they? Because they're not that highly paid anyway. So the cost of chocolate for all kids in all classes would be pretty draconian. So what we try to do as teachers, don't we, is to get our students to buy in to the learning experience, something called engagement that we'll pick up on a little bit later. But the basic idea of autonomy supporting style is that instead of going into classrooms and being authoritarian, in the sense of, oh, these are the fixed rules, you must do what I say, listen to me, that kind of thing, which often is an effective way of keeping the students down, so to speak. If you go in with that very authoritarian tone, students are often quiet and most of them would acquiesce. But in the longer term, it's not as productive as that is less controlling. That doesn't mean there isn't structure. It's not a question of this argument between authoritarian style and laissez-faire. It often things, oh, as soon as you say, oh, it's not controlling, it's, oh, let the kids do what they want. And we know that's probably worse in many ways than a more authoritarian style. So it's a style that has been referred to by John Marshall Reeve. And I'll just read his definition out because it's a little bit technical, but we will strip it down to specifics, right? He defined it as a coherent cluster of teacher-provided instructional behaviours. In other words, a set of communication pedagogic strategies that collectively communicate to students. And this is the important point, that it affects their perception and feelings, that communicate to students an interpersonal tone of support and understanding, such as, I am your ally. You know, it's a very American term, and he is American. You know, I'm with you. I'm here to support you and your strivings. In other words, what you're trying to get out of being here, some meaning, some purpose. So it's got that kind of very strong, if you like, existential base to it, is that you teach in a way that the students perceive that to the students that you're there to help them, not just to make them sit there and control them and do this thing called school. So the question then becomes, well, what are these behaviours, that if teachers can do these skillfully and authentically, will create this interpersonal tone of support and understanding. So you work with me on that. So what does that mean to you? I mean, if I say to you, what's an interpersonal tone of support and understanding? What would you interpret as that?
Yeah, okay. So here's my interpretation. Interpersonal tone of support and understanding. I think in many episodes past, we actually talked about the importance of trying to establish rapport with your students. And you certainly cannot do that if you go in with, you know, if you believe that as a teacher, you are master of everything and you control everything and you can't even stand a little bit of things that do not follow what I would call your own scheme of things in your head. So for example, if a child is fidgeting and you don't like it and you are telling the child every second to sit still, I suppose that is not an interpersonal tone of support and understanding. That's more of like a controlling type of language. And I think this is what John Marshall Reeves refers to as maybe informational non-controlling language. But I think I need you to unpack this a little bit more, for us to unpack this a little bit more. So he says we need to use informational non-controlling language. So non-controlling language, I think we are quite clear. It's not always, you know, every second you teachers who maybe rightly or wrongly believe that everything that a child does, I must control. But what is informational language then?
Well, basically, if we think about it in the classroom, that as a teacher, we have an intent to teach the learning outcomes, right?
Yep.
Now, when students are in the classroom, very often, they're not even told what the learning outcomes are. You know, all they know is they're going into the geography class, the history class, the English class. And for many students, I feel that a lot of the subjects are what is taught is to them not seen as meaningful. They don't kind of connect to it. And what you have to do as a teacher, I think, is to kind of be able to talk to the students, say, this is what we're learning, and show them what the purpose is, show some relevance and connect it to their worlds. For example, if I'm teaching, I didn't have to, I had a job where I was teaching communication skills to craft apprentices, and these are people doing carpentry, motor vehicle, welding courses, and a lot of them, you know, couldn't see, well, why am I doing communication skills? But when I was able to bring it down to things like when you deal with customers, if you want to make friends, if you want to find girlfriends, boyfriends, those kind of things, that it's really useful if you have skill in the way you speak and how you speak and how you ask questions and answer questions, how you use body language. And once they kind of see that there is some information about what they're learning that's relevant, and it's not just the information, it's part of the other behaviors. For example, is when students turn around and say, oh, I don't really want to learn this stuff, and then they moan about something, it's being able to take that negative effect and not say, you just got to do it because I said so, it's on the syllabus, but to, you know, be honest sometimes and say, well, to be honest about it, I'd probably agree with you that, you know, do we need to learn this? But given that this is a syllabus and I've got to teach it and I'm going to try to make it as less boring or at least a bit more meaningful to you, the students can see that they're engaged with you and that you're empathic to their feelings. And sometimes be prepared to say, well, okay, we won't do that now because it's late in the day, you're bored, we'll do something else. Well, what else in this syllabus? If they know the learning outcomes, they can say, well, can we do this or can we do that? It's having that flexibility of responding situationally to how they feel. And when they get that creates a tone that you're with them and that you understand them. So if you say, guys, look, we've got to learn this now, it is a bit boring, we'll do it as a quiz, we'll do a bit of a role play and we'll try to make it a bit of fun, and when we do this, get it done, then we'll move on to something that you find more interesting in the syllabus. It's that kind of flexibility. Does that make sense?
Yep, it does. So
it's a give and take thing. It's a bit like being married, Mark, I guess, you know, kind of, you want to watch the football and, you know, your wife might want to watch whatever it is, might want to watch the ladies' football instead of Manchester United, which are doing quite well at the moment, Mark, before you come in on that.
Yep.
But it's that kind of give and take bit and that kind of empathy and say, well, let's watch the first half of the United game and then we'll watch, you know, the ladies football and then we can video and take the rest and you can watch it later. It's that kind of not, oh, well, I'm, you know, I'm the man of the house and yeah, you're going to have to watch it and that's it sort of thing.
Yeah. So then I think it's also similar to what you mentioned earlier. And this is something that even John Marshall Reeve advocates, and that is, besides using informational non-controlling language, is also to communicate the purpose or the value of the learning, which is, I think is quite similar to what you alluded to in what you said just now.
Yeah, but this is the thing, isn't it? That it's very hard for students sometimes to see the meaning and purpose in many of the things that are taught in schools.
Exactly.
I was able when I worked with the craft apprentices to show the usefulness of good interpersonal communication, and they bought into that. Then once they buy into it and they have that trust and respect, you say, well, guys, look, further down the line, you might be running your own business. You might want to make a lot of money because, you know, when you speak to 18, 19-year-old lads, that sounds good. And what you'll have to do then is you'd have to be able to manage your business and you'd have to be able to read forms and you'd have to fill some forms in and you'd have to be able to write clearly and precisely and you'd have to do tender things, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes some sense. And then you can say, right, well, okay, well, let's write a letter to a company explaining what my business is about and what I can offer, you know, as a carpenter or a plumber or a motor vehicle maintenance person, and also a CV. And I get across, look, when you apply for jobs, the first impression is your CV. And if it's poorly written, then right away, they're not interested in you. So you've got to find the meaning and purpose. And once they see that, then it's like anything else, that once they've bought into that they're learning useful things, then you can just build on that relationship.
Yeah. So I think that's important because, you know, when I meet new lecturers who join for the first time, one of the things I always tell them is Poly did not hire you because of your devastatingly good looks. That's reason number two. Reason number one is really you need to try and help them understand why they are learning what they are learning. And because you come from the industry, the best person to do it is yourself. So I think this is where I think many teachers just maybe assume that just because they're in a course, the students are automatically interested and will learn. So I think we do need to spend some time really communicating the purpose and connecting the learning so that they actually understand what they are learning might be useful for them down the road, as opposed to maybe learning an abstract mathematical formula that they think they will never ever see again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean that's fundamental. Even if you compare, you know, remember I think we did a pod once on the andragogy pedagogy debate, and you know, is there differences between adult learners and you know, kids at school? Well, we know we've both taught both, right? And we know we're teaching adult learners. If they don't see the purpose in their learning, and we try to be telling them do this and do that, and we don't allow them to share their experience and their equity with us, we can find ourselves in a lot of trouble, can't we?
Precisely.
Equally, you know, with students, and they don't have the same level of experience and they might not be as forthcoming in all cases, specifically as adults. But if they're finding it boring and meaningless, you know, they're likely to just disengage or even be disruptive. They might not articulate it in the same way, but if they, it's still that sense of why am I learning this stuff, and why am I being told I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and I don't see no purpose in it, and there's no flexibility in this, and it's boring. You might get a minimal level of what's called behavioral engagement, but that's about it.
Right. Okay. So I would think also that it's related to the next point that we are going to talk about. And this is going to be somewhat of a, I would say, counterintuitive actions that teachers normally take. And that is, we should, as part of being autonomy supporting teachers, is really to acknowledge and accept students' expressions of negative effect. You need to break this down for us then. What does that mean when we say acknowledge and accept students' expressions of negative effect?
Well, negative effect is basically them having a bit of a whinge, if you like, a bit of a complaint. Why are we doing this, sir or chair? Oh, what's the purpose of this chair? You know, if I'm going to put it in the Singaporean thing, is that to accept that, well, okay, I mean, for example, if I had to teach, say, you know, Shakespeare or Thomas Hardy, even more obscure, I mean, to 12-year-old students, and they're saying, why am I learning this? I mean, I've got to accept, look, I think, it, you know, I mean, to me, I think that's quite boring, okay? To say, yeah, I accept it. You know, you feel it's boring, and I'm totally going to take that. I'm not even going to try and justify that it's not. But you've then got to give them a rationale, haven't you? If they're doing O-level English, or, you know, GCSE English, or whatever you want to call it, and it's on the syllabus, and they know they want to get their O-level English literature because they need it on their CV, I've got to say to them, look, yeah, okay, I totally get it. But we've got to do this. So how can we? I'll throw it back at them and say, okay, given that you've got to understand what this writer is trying to get across in terms of the plot or the theme, make it like, you know, like when we play football, right? I didn't like some of the training. I would like to play football. And if you said to kids, just play football, they'd play football. They wouldn't want to do the jumping and the skipping and the jumping over, you know, a lot of things. But if you don't do that, then you're not going to be successful at what you've got to do. So I'll say, look, we have to understand these writers, and we have to look at this, and we have to do this in order for you to pass your exam. So you're always, but don't start saying to, oh, no, it is really interesting, and shut up sort of thing. Take the negative effect, but say, well, okay, what's your option? Look, if you look at the new manager that's gone in at Man United, and he, what one thing he did do, and this, you know, this is very relevant, is that he noticed that they weren't putting the fitness and the running in. And he said to them, you're not doing that. But he was prepared to say, I'm bringing you in to make you do extra running. But he actually came in and did it himself as well.
Yeah.
So he kind of, at one level, had gotten to do something, but he took it on as well. Okay, it's my responsibility as well. And I'll take the punishment of doing the extra running. So as a teacher, is accept that there is some, sometimes that the students have got a point. And if it is late on in the day and the students seem genuinely tired, they've made effort and they said, look, you know, we really can't concentrate on this and it's getting to us a bit, then say, okay, well, fine, I'll get that. What can we do about it? So it's take the negative effect and throw it back at them and say, well, okay, given that we're here, I used to say to students sometimes on the Monday morning when they'd come in, you know, and then say, oh, I don't want to be here. I don't like this. I don't want to come into college. And I'd sort of say, yeah, get you guys. I used to say to the boys, I could say that then. I wouldn't be able to say it now. It wouldn't be politically correct. But there used to be, I thought, a good-looking female singer called Kim Wilde. And I used to say, look, guys, if I'm being honest, I'd rather be on a yacht in the south of France with Kim Wilde than having to come in myself. So, you know, I was taking that negative effect. And so I share, you know, your feeling. It's a wet Monday morning and we've got to do this. And they'd have a laugh. And I say, but guys, look, we're here for an hour. We can moan and whinge, but let's see if we can do something productive. You know, let's look at something that's relevant on the syllabus and do a bit of stuff. That they'd be out, sort of be, yeah, okay, lol, you know, to use a Singaporean.
Yeah.
They're jolly down, and because you've had a bit of a laugh, it changes the emotional tone. And I think that goes back to this, you know, instructional tone and support. The teacher understands it's Monday morning and we'd rather not be doing this. And, you know, you're not sort of like,
yeah,
you know, bobbing them off with full, oh, but it's really important that you do that, you know, well, okay, they're not going to buy that, are they? So,
yeah,
That's it, really.
So far, we have covered three of this, and I'm beginning to see a lot of relationships between each and every one of them. So would you say, like, this could be like a Russian doll effect for autonomy?
Absolutely, sporting? Yeah, that's a great analogy. It's when you put, when he says a coherent cluster of teacher-provided instructional behaviour, it's all of these things synergistically. It's a bit like, you know, if you go for an interview, there's a number of things, isn't it? The way you shake someone's hand, the way you look at someone, the eye contact, the body language, the ability to know when to listen, asking the right sort of question in the right context, not saying too much, not saying too little. It's a combination of things, isn't it?
Yeah,
that, you know, you get all of those wrong and you tend not to get the job, don't you?
Yep, exactly.
It doesn't guarantee success if you do all of them right. But what it basically means is when you walk out that door, the people interview it will say, yeah, good candidate. It could well be that somebody has got something on their CV that's more useful and also come across as all right. But it's a bit like you can only do your best performance. And what we know, teaching is a complex activity. And even if you use an autonomy supported style, there will be some students who don't buy into that. And then you've got individual relationship or discipline issues to deal with. And equally, there will be days and times when a lot of the students just a little bit fed up or whatever, and they're just not in a good mood. And, you know, but even then, you're at least able to accept, guys, I can see you in a bad mood, you know, and something might have happened, you know, with kids, that someone's fallen out or someone's flirted with someone's boyfriend or girlfriend and it's had a contagion effect. And you just say, look, you're a bit fed up. So how do we deal with this?
Yeah.
So and I then, think it settles them down like a bit and it's kind of, hopefully you can come up with something, but it's better than shouting at them and them reacting negatively and everybody leaves with that sort of tired feeling at the end of the day or the end of the lesson.
Yeah, I think that also helps to acknowledge that we are teaching students and they are also normal humans and not robots who are there just to, you know, pick up everything we just throw at them. So I think that is a good tip to really acknowledge and spend time acknowledging their negative effects. So thanks for that. So let's move on to the next one, which I thought was also quite interesting, which is and this is going to be also quite interesting because I personally like to do this, and I'll share with you a quick story after this. And that is listening to students and encouraging them to ask questions. And this is something I realized that our students struggle with quite a fair bit in Singapore. Not so much I'm listening to them, but encouraging them to ask questions. Usually, they have none. And I remember one student actually coming up to tell me, he said, you know, Mark, you are one of the first of few lecturers who always encourages me to ask questions. And he has now forced me to think about the type of questions I want to ask. So I thought that was a win for me. So I'll chalk that up as a win. But yeah, so listening to students and encouraging them to ask questions, maybe the bigger question would be is, what kind of questions should we be encouraging them to ask?
Well, there's two aspects. I mean, we could do an old podcast on questions. I mean, it was, I think, Anthony Robbins, the famous success coach who we've mentioned a few times, who actually earns more than you and me, surprisingly. And he's kind of, one of his statements is, we learn everything through the use of questions. Because if you actually look at what a question is, if we can get students to ask questions, to say, I don't understand this, or can you give me another example, or how does this connect to that, or what does this mean? It shows that there's a knowledge and an understanding gap. So that's what teaching is about, isn't it? I mean, the core principle of learning is to activate students' prior knowledge to identify knowledge gaps, misconceptions, and gaps in making connections to build understanding. So once students are confident in the classroom to be able to say, Chair, I don't see how this connects to that, or you're talking about this, and then you said that, and that don't make sense because it appears contradictory, you're in a then position to say, well, let's go back. Let's look at what this means. Let's look at this assumption. Let's look at this concept. Let's look at that. And then other students may be chipping in, and that's where, if you're encouraging students to ask questions, more of them are likely to do it. And what that means is that when you're trying to make sense of something in the class, other students may come in and say, oh, yeah, I was looking at that, and this is what I've got. So you've actually got good peer sort of instruction going on. So questions are so fundamental to the learning process because, in a sense, it's thinking is nothing more than asking and answering questions by using cognitive processes. We've got to analyze it, we've got to compare and contrast, we've got to make inference interpretations, we've got to evaluate, and that's critical thinking, isn't it? So it's such a big part of, I think, this autonomy supported style, is that when students feel that you're on their side, they're more likely to say, I don't know, Chair, you know. Whereas if they don't, they don't want to appear to be stupid and be told, well, pay attention, lad. You've not been listening. It's your fault sort of thing. I mean, I know when I was at school, asking a question was kind of, it could evoke in some teachers those looks of, you ain't been listening, sort of thing. Well, okay, I've been listening, but don't understand it. So that's what makes that such a big thing. So the type of questions you want students to ask is to say, what's the meaning of this? Or how is this connected to that? Or if this is the case, then why is this occurring? So you're getting them to do thinking type questions. And if you teach them that there are questions that are related to analysis and evaluation and compare and contrast, they will start to ask those kind of questions, and you'll use that model of thinking. And that's great to build understanding. So it's a no-brainer, that one. It's such a big part of it. And all of those things come together. If you create that rapport and you let students speak, and whether sometimes it's negative, but they like you and respect you and trust you, then you can then get them to say, well, let's ask questions about improving our understanding of this topic that we have to do. And hopefully they see some meaning in having to do it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's fair enough. And I think I will continue to do that because I realize that I shouldn't just be the only one asking questions, but also to spend time getting my students to think. And I do think that getting them to ask good quality questions makes them a bit more metacognitive.
Yeah, and we've had that with metacognition, you know, is kind of, in my opinion anyway, one of the real art subjects in learning today. We've got to get students to be able to understand themselves as human beings cognitively, effectively, emotionally, obviously, and behaviorally, because it's a confusing world. I mean, it's an overused term, you know, the VUCA world, but it is like that. And that's why I think a lot of youngsters are struggling, because they're looking for meaning, and it's a confusing world, and it's a frightening world in many respects when you put the news on. So to get students to be metacognitive and say, yeah, look, life is tough. Suffering is an existential thing. Whether you're suffering for the fact that you're struggling with school or getting on with your parents or peers or things seem hard sometimes, and we've got to build resilience, because life is like that. It's not that easy. It's challenging. And I think we've got to be honest with students and say, look, it is hard. You know, it's not a breeze. We can't keep you in cotton wool all the time. Life just ain't like that. When you go to work, you've got to go in and you've got to arrive on time and you've got to take orders. And sometimes you have to work with people you don't like. And not all jobs are intrinsically motivating. In fact, I think for a lot of people, I mean, me and you have been lucky. We do jobs that we are passionate about. So if there's a bit of it we don't like, say some administrative thing or whatever it is, because we have such a sense of meaning to improving teaching and learning and the benefits that brings all round, and the intrinsic feeling of worth, that when you see people succeed, we get a buzz out of that. But if you're doing a job that you don't feel much intrinsic motivation, but you have to earn a living, you've got to do it.
That's right.
You've got to then think, well, if I don't like it, what am I going to do about it? And that often means you've got to learn new skills. And to learn new skills, you've got to make effort, and you've got to be able to learn better.
Right. Okay. Which brings us to the last one, which is going to be quite interesting, because I do see that maybe there's an opportunity for us to clarify something here. And that is to continue to build autonomy supporting behaviors in students is to allow students choices, preferences whenever possible on how they learn and the context of learning. Now, I need you to explain this, because isn't this learning styles then?
Oh, well, that's a nice one, isn't it? Well, see, there's a difference between a learning preference and the learning style. Now, let me give you an example. I like it when I'm learning something, to have some choice in how I learn it. For example, let's take learning to play a sport. I want to get good at the sport, but I don't want to just be told I've got to skip, like for boxing, when I train for boxing. Yeah, I'll accept that I might have to do some skipping for certain things, but I want to be able to have some choice and say, well, I really don't fancy the skipping. And can I do some weights instead? I feel a little bit more. I don't want the instructors to say, no, you just got to skip. But to say, well, are you going to have to do the skipping this week or within the schedule? But if you feel for the next 20 minutes, you'd rather do the weights, then do the weights. So it's giving preferences. And also, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty good. I mean, because we have to put a lot of hours in, I can get up early in the morning and put a shift in. Equally, I can put a shift in late at night, right?
Yep.
But sometimes I feel I'd rather do it in the morning. I just feel this morning I feel quite crispy. I'll put it on. And I don't mind having a bit of music on, but I don't want rap music or techno music on, because that's just going to do my head in, right? So I would probably put on some ABBA, or I might have a bit of Rolling Stone. I mean, I'll put on the music I like. So to have some music I like, if I'm doing some work that I can concentrate mainly on the task, and the music just kind of makes me feel a little bit like, you know, awake and alive. So that's a preference. So, but there might be someone else, you know, when you go in the gym, there's some people who like that boom, boom music, you know, it makes them feel better in the gym. It makes me feel sick. So these are preferences, but it's not a learning style. It's not that, oh, I am programmed only to learn with a visual stimulus, because in fact, we're all mainly visual learners. So it's not about a learning style. It's just a bit of a preference. Okay. I want to work at this time, or can I have some flexibility in the kind of activities that I'm doing in the focal points, but I'm still going to learn to be able to play football, do the boxing, write the essay, that kind of thing, or do this particular assignment. And I do think that's so important, because I do think it makes people feel a bit better, and they've got some sense of control over it, as, oh, I've got to do this, and it's like, oh no, as opposed to, well, you've got to do it at some stage, but now you really don't feel like it. I'll take the negative effect, do the thing that you prefer to do, but don't let that become something that you can always have, you know, as a student. You can't just do what you want all the time, but you've got to take responsibility, but there is some flexibility within that responsibility.
Nice.
Okay. That really makes sense to me, because I know in my own life, you know, and we've managed lots of people at work, and your style is the same as mine, that when we take people on, unfortunately, you know, hopefully in our work, that the people come in with an intrinsic interest in teaching and learning. And if they don't, we don't want them, do we, if we're going to be honest?
Right. Yeah.
So we make an assumption that they want to be good teachers, and they're prepared to put a shift in, and they believe in the getting students to learn well and be engaged and be able to develop as people and all those kind of things, that we're not going to go around micromanaging them. Equally, that if they need our help, we'll give them that help. So we're prepared to provide structure when needed, and hopefully that they're gonna want to do the job well. So if they come to us and say, I'd like to develop my IT skills, I think there's some new software, like every week you talk about this new tool, they come along and say, oh, is there any workshops provided where I can learn to do this?
Right.
So it really boils down to that. I think that's important. And if you've got the right people to use a controlling style, you imagine, like, you know, me and you, if we had a boss who every Wednesday you've got to spend 3 hours and show everything you've done, and simply because it's, you know, they're checking up on you. Fair enough.
Right.
If you know, look, periodically we're all going to get together and share stuff, or you want to share stuff. But when it's purely you feel they're checking up on you, and if you're not in your room, well, where were you, kind of thing, that kind of stuff, it really grates on you. But unfortunately, if you've got people who you have to chase up, you have to do that. But the idea is, let's try to have environments where it works not on that style. We never had a problem. I mean, you know, I remember when I took you on, you know, years ago, because I was your boss for a while and you were mine. But that's how we treated each other. You know,
right.
It was like, I wasn't knocking on your door, what are you doing, Mark? Well, tell me what you've done in the last 10 minutes. You wouldn't have liked it, would you? You know, I never did it, did I? You know, and you always come and say, what else can I do? And, you know, I've got an idea.
Yeah,
you know, it was easy. And when I worked for you, you weren't so. So, oh, Dennis, I went in your office, and if I, where were you? I said, having a cup of tea. If you would have said to me, how long have you been down there? All right, fair enough. If I'm supposed to be doing something, but I wouldn't have been happy with you. I wouldn't be on this podcast channel with you, would I?
Yeah, true.
But obviously, there are people that don't behave in that way. But the idea is, we try with this approach. That's the approach. But when people violate that, and that's another podcast, how do you deal with people who don't respond to this? And that's one of the weaknesses of the approach, because look, you know, and I know that not everybody's that well wired for whatever reason, and they will take advantage of the flexibility and that, and you have to deal with that. But the idea is, if we have this as the regulatory or the preferred modus operandi, it's better for, you know, the long-term well-being and development of students. It's more consistent with the autonomy, mastery, competence, and relatedness approach.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I feel that it has worked for me, but I've had students where I've had to say, look, I'm being reasonable, I'm giving you a choice, I'm listening to what you said, but you're not doing it. So now we're in a different position, aren't we?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So I think that thanks for clearing that up. And that's important. So I'm going to do a quick summary before we move on to the next component. And that is, one, for us to really be autonomy supporting, is we do need to establish an interpersonal tone of support and understanding. And this includes, one, using informational non-controlling language with our students. Two, communicating the purpose or the value of the learning, which is, I think, critical, and we have established that. Three, acknowledge and accept that students are humans and they will have expressions of negative effect from time to time. And instead of suppressing it, it might be good maybe to acknowledge it and maybe deal with it. Four is listen to students actively and encourage them to ask questions. And five, allowing students choices, preferences, whenever possible, on how they learn and the context of learning. Now, Dan, I think you have also spoken a bit about having this actually encourages students to be a little bit more intrinsically motivated. But what I wanted to talk about is when you do this well, okay, is really and correct me if I'm wrong, if there's a cognitive mistake here. But when you do this well, you start to build students who are a bit more agentic. So can you explain to, or can you share, what does an agentic learner mean? And then we can go from there.
Yeah, that's right. I'll be honest with you. I think if I look back on my school kind of career, I wasn't too bad. I did get chastised, and I was caned a couple of times, but most people
only a couple of times.
Yeah, so that was pretty good, really. And I never got, you know, the times I got caned were things like there was kids there who would try to pick on you, and you'd have a fight with them, and you'd get the teacher would catch you, and because you were fighting, it was a caning offence. So whoever started it was not necessarily the issue. In fact, what would happen is if you were fighting, you were given the option of going in the ring with the PE teacher and settling it. Now, to suggest that today would be, people would see that as ridiculous. But actually, I thought it was it worked, because the kids I had fights with, most of the time, would go in the ring, we'd have a round, and at the end of it, we'd shake hands and forget about it. But it's a different paradigm today, so I wouldn't get into a discussion with that. Though we could do a podcast on it sometime, it'd be interesting. But so those kind of things. And also, we had teachers who just were pretty poor teachers, and we used to take the mickey out of them a bit, and if they caught you, you'd get caned for that as well. Anyway, so, but the point is this, that you can have in the classroom, if you've got a controlling style, you can have kids who are doing some work or trying to do some work just to keep out of trouble. And that is called behavioural engagement. So someone could walk into your classroom and see kids quiet and think, oh, Mark's a good teacher. The kids are not making a noise. There isn't a lot of chatter. No one's climbing on tables and think, oh, that's a good teacher. But the kids are actually not really learning anything. So there's some behavioural engagement, but not cognitive engagement. Now, when we talk about cognitive engagement, when students are doing something, but they're actually thinking about this, and hold on, what does this mean? They're actually trying to solve a maths problem by working out what it is, rather than just writing some stuff just to look like they're doing it. Because it's a waste of time if they're not actually building knowledge and understanding. What's the point in doing it? It's like giving students activity and saying, oh, I've got active learning going. So you've got kids doing stuff, but if it's got no meaning and no purpose, that's as bad as a boring lecture where the students are sitting there glazed eyes. It's as bad. Now, what we would like, obviously, is the students doing it, the behavioural aspect. We also would want the cognitive aspect. They're actually mentally engaged. But wouldn't it be nice if they actually also have some interest in it, you know, which is what's referred to as emotional engagement. Now, that don't mean they're like passionate. Oh, I love doing these French verbs or whatever it is. But they can, you know, they have a bit of fun, and it's not too boring for them, and they're prepared to maintain interest and have a little bit of enthusiasm. So that's pretty good. That's good engagement. We've got behavioral engagement, we've got cognitive engagement and emotional engagement. John Marshall Reeve introduced a fourth aspect of engagement, and he called it agentic engagement. And I think that's where you're coming from. And that basically means that the students are prepared to take on responsibility for their own learning and say, right, I'm engaged, I'm doing all this stuff, but I want to be really involved in. And that's when they start asking questions. Well, they don't just sit there and, oh yeah, I understand this, and take it out. They say, oh, I understand this, but what about this, and how does that connect with that? And that's where, you know, students are really going beyond the minimal aspects of learning. Well, I can do it, I've got enough to pass the exam, so I really want to understand this a bit better, and I'm prepared to ask questions and contribute. I'll go away and read something and come in and say, Chair, I read this article, like we're talking about autonomy supporting staff. Well, if we were teaching this and our students understand it, they're engaged, you know, they seem to quite enjoy it. And then next week someone comes in and says, oh, I found a good article adding to what engagement is. Somebody else who'd written about it and shares it with the class. So you've got students actually co-constructing knowledge with you and taking responsibility, because that's what self-directed learning is about. It's about being an agentic learner. So if we can get all of that type of engagement in, then, you know, that's the ideal learning situation. And that's what makes teaching really good fun, isn't it? When the students are learning, and not only that, you know, they're showing interest and enthusiasm. I think it's, oh, I saw this podcast on Desi and talking about this. How does that connect to what we're doing? That's you really cracked it then. You know, that's the ideal teacher-learner relationship.
Yeah. So in case you were wondering, what does an agentic learner look like? There's a list that I think Reeves has come up with. And I'm going to read them. And then after that, what we will do is I would suggest that we take them as a whole. Because this is really like the ultimate student that you will see. And I'm not sure how we are going to... I hope I'm not putting any people off by actually just reading up from this list. But I think it's worth talking about it. And what we will do is, after I shared the list of how we would be able to recognize an agentic learner, we will do a bit of a summary, and then we will wrap up this segment. So when you talk about agentic learners, they should have the following skills and attributes. One, aware of being metacognitive and what this entails. In terms of personal self-regulation and the ability to be self-directed. And this is important because we teach students, remember, some of them may not necessarily be adults. So this is going to be important. Yep. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And that's what we're getting, because if they are fully engaged, and we have been teaching them how to think and how to... what metacognition is, they're in a great learning position, aren't they? Because they're engaged in the learning process, and they understand, that's the important thing, is they understand how the learning process works. And by asking questions, they're going to fill their knowledge gaps. They're going to clear up misperceptions. They're going to get a bit of understanding. They're going to get better grades. And it's going to be more interesting and more engaging. So it's a total package, isn't it? That in a sense, we're getting them engaged, and through that, they are learning better and having a better experience.
Great. So it's also linked to the next point, which is they also then understand the key aspects of how people learn. And because of that, they actually have competence in using a range of cognitive strategies. More importantly, know when to use them and for what specific purpose and goals. And they actually make an effort to frame clear, challenging, realistic goals. And they also plan, implement, monitor, and evaluate their strategies for meeting these learning goals. And last but not least, actually are aware of the range of personal barriers to maintaining motivation, effort, but they have a strong belief that they can actually meet these challenging goals. So is this like the holy grail of having every student like that in your classroom?
Ah, oh, well, that is the holy grail, absolutely. You're never going to get it. I mean, it's a regulatory idea, isn't it? And it all makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All connected together. The students know how to learn. You call them. They've learned the strategies. They are able to learn. They've got self-efficacy. They're achieving mastery, competence. They feel that they're part of something with the group, with you, the relationship. Aspect, and they've got autonomy. They can come into the class and say, oh, well, you know, last week we were looking at this. Well, I've read something that challenges that, and say to you, well, what do you think, Chair? And you know, you've got to then meet that challenge and say, well, yeah, I can see what you say. And you know, this is perfect. That's learning, isn't it? That's what we want. If we can, I mean, if we add, I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, creative teaching not just being a cognitive activity, but you know, I talked about it being almost a philosophical thing in the sense if all teachers could get, well, most teachers could get most students learning like this, you know, that's the future of mankind. We might solve the existential problems that are really glaring at us now in terms of the environment, you know, conflict, wars, unkindness, dealing with malevolence and all these kind of things. We might, you know, this is our secret to survival, I think, kind of teachers teaching in these ways and getting more students to learn like this. Now, it's challenging, it's massive, but what are the options if we don't have teachers teaching well and try to get students to be more educated and have a better moral landscape? Then it's, you know, the scenarios could be quite grim.
Right. Okay, so that's a good wrap up for what we were talking about. I'm glad we actually tried to tackle this today. Gives us a good reminder of, other than the technical aspects of teaching and learning, and how to build good autonomy supporting strategies for our students. So let's move on to part two, which is my favorite part of the podcast, as always. And this is where we share something that we have found interesting, something that we found inspiring, and it could be something that we would have read, something that we would have watched, or maybe even a podcast that we may have listened to besides our own, of course. So you want to go first then? Anything that you found interesting?
Well, I've actually been on holiday this week with a close friend who we grew up together in East London, and we've had many conversations about things. And that one thing I've learned is that we don't, even though we're very close friends and we agree on lots of things, there's some things we don't fundamentally agree on, right? I won't go into what they are, but we're able, and this is, I think, the important thing, is that we can agree to have a fundamentally different perception about something and not fall out,
right?
And kind of that reinforces something that we want to foster in students, is that because you have a difference of opinion on something, it doesn't then have to be a reason not to continue communicating and not trying to learn more and accept things and try to find better solutions. I mean, that's just one thing. Also, I revisited some of the people that, because I'm going to write a few articles on personality theory over the coming months. So I went back and read more of Eric Fromm and his personality theory.
Oh, I remember that book.
And it kind of reminded me how challenging personality is, because even though Fromm is, he's an existentialist in the sense that he looks at the human condition in very stark terms, but he was quite positive in saying that man has free will and can improve. But he says there's lots of aspects of human personality that are barriers to good thinking, barriers to us being productive, and we have to work very hard at developing our character, but we can improve as people through effort and learning. And it just reminded me that this type of thinking has been going around a long time, and it's not just a new idea. So one of the great writers of our time, in my opinion, along with Viktor Frankl and others.
Right. Okay. That reminds me, I think I should go and revisit the book. But I wanted to share this somewhat nifty tool. Caveat, I've not actually tried it, but it is one of those lists. It has made a list of 6 best edutech tools that we should try. And it is, and I'm going to just read it because it's actually quite interesting because it uses VR technology. And the premise is that while platforms like Zoom and Google Meet and MS Teams do a good job of letting people talk to each another and giving us options for breaking larger meetings into smaller, more intimate groups via the use of breakout rooms, the cult of pedagogy claims that the experience is still kind of flat. So they are recommending, what if we use VR, virtual reality technology, to create online spaces that feel more three-dimensional, that allows participants to move through virtual spaces as if they are physically in a room together. Now, that's quite amazing. So they are recommending that one of the tools that we can look at is called Frame. Now, in the world of Frame, a host can create an environment like an office, a lounge, or even an island and populate that environment with artwork, documents, videos, or any kind of materials needed for a lesson or other experience. So, something to think about, something interesting. What do you think then? You think that you know, the time is ripe for us to look at three-dimensional meeting applications?
Well, I'm a mixed thing. It sounds good, but the question is it going to be time-consuming to set this stuff up? Because I even find trying to use Teams and Zoom sometimes confusing when little bits of it go. And to have this virtual environment with all this kind of stuff working and setting up, is it something like kind of too many cherries on the cake, but the cake is a bit dark? I mean, the concept's good, and I think, you know, I'm all for looking at it. I don't know. All I know is I don't find the technology always that user-friendly as it starts to become more complicated, and particularly if it's free. So I don't know. But again, of course, it sounds good. It was. Can you remember a while back there was this thing called Second Life?
Yeah, I think it might be similar.
Yeah, there were people, IT people. Remember our friend Eric, brilliant guy, like super, and he can set all this up. And he was saying, "Oh, it, you know, we're going to be learning in Second Life." And my feeling was, one is, I had no idea how to set it up. I never had the IT competence to get anywhere near. But I thought to myself, "Well, you know, if we're living in this first life, let's try to make communication rather than create avatars who could talk to each other." I kind of found it a little bit kind of. You know, kind of, hold on a minute. I do feel in these kind of communication tools, the worst thing is they break down and things happen. But I think anybody who's got good communication skills using something like Zoom and Teams, you can make it functional. If you start, it's almost like trying to make it too comfortable and that it becomes, oh, it's also comfortable, but maybe people have just got to learn to pay attention and have a little bit of discipline in the session and not, oh, well, I'd like the background to be pink. I'd feel better. Are we getting a bit soft? Is it, you know, we keep saying that we're making school and learning too easy for some students, you know, and that's why we're getting the snowflake generation, you know, the Larry Wingate argument. Maybe as adults, it's like having remote control. At the end of the day, if I have to get up and press a button, is that really hard? And do we want the remote control that, you know, does this extra thing? Well, all I want to do is I want to be able to watch the football. If I have to get up and turn a knob to watch it, I'm okay with that, rather than have a remote control that can put a bit of music in and all the stats keep coming up. And in the end, like, it's, I don't know, I mean, is it, I'm just posing the question here, you know.
Yeah,
people think about it. So yeah, for, you know, let's look at these tools and let lecturers, teachers, whatever, find them. But it is all about good communication and clarity and purpose and relationships and good pedagogy. And yeah, certainly technology can enhance aspects of the learning process. And in our next episode, but the one after, we're going to revisit these tools and we can critically look at them and see if we can come up with, you know, what is a pragmatically workable passage. A package, sorry, for most teachers, because a lot of them will think, oh dear, have I got to now set all this up, as well as, is it another task that I've got to do and it's more work? And I'm tired anyway, you know. So,
yeah. Okay. So that really brings us to the end of the 49th episode. Thank you for being with us. Now, if you please do us a favor. If you found this episode interesting, especially the part on building autonomy, supportive strategies, please do share this. And also, please do write to us. And you can find us by writing an email to us at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, it is evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. So that's done and dusted. So take care, everyone. And we'll see you in our 50th episode. So take care and goodbye.
Yep, and goodbye from me.